Whenever feasible, one should always try to eat the root. Would you join me at the table?
Welcome to Eat the Rootcast, a podcast about NBC's Hannibal and the Hannibal Lecter books and movies. Cooper. I'm Cooper, and I'm joined by...
This is Miko.
This is Ophelia.
Wow, you guys got giggly there without anything to talk about. Tonight we are drinking Barbera from Cooper's Hawk, a local Chicago restaurant and winery. It is a lovely wine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we are talking about Hannibal's second episode, entitled Amuse-Bouche.
Amusement for the mouth.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone knows we will be trying to not spoil anything beyond episode 2, because Miko is going through the series for the first time, but book spoilers have a tendency of showing up in our podcast. I want to say that this episode is written by a man whose middle name is Danger.
Literally?
Literally. Jim Danger Gray.
I want to know how old he is, but we can't find a page for him.
Wikipedia has nothing. He is not a clickable link on Wikipedia. So we ended last episode a little early because we were running very long.
Yeah.
But we had mentioned that really a lot of what makes Hannibal interesting as a TV series was Brian Fuller, the creator, asking himself, what would David Lynch do with a Hannibal Lecter character?
Mm-hmm.
And there were little pieces of that in episode 1. But right away in episode 2, we start to see the DNA of David Lynch coming across.
A lot of it in episode 2. There were moments where I went, I know where with that, what inspired that moment.
Yeah.
Well, what I like about Brian Fuller's design is he's not afraid to show the DNA of his influences. He recognizes that all TV shows owe to the TV shows that came before them, and that without Twin Peaks... Really, most of television wouldn't be the same right now because Twin Peaks did something different and unique. And Hannibal definitely owes a great debt to Twin Peaks as a show. What I found really interesting going into episode 2 is it really feels like Network Notes and CSI meets David Lynch. Because they amped up the amount of time we spend with the lab geeks.
Yes.
Which I love, because I love the lab geeks, but that feels very CSI.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it was.
You have a team now that's, you know, that has their moments, and each one has their personality. And they have a nice series of people here. And it still makes me laugh, and I'm sure that he hates the fact that I think of this every time he's on, but the guy from the state is... But it's wonderful that Scott Thompson is the guy who's always out on the field. I can't remember his character name now.
Would it be Zeller or Price? The younger one or the older one?
It's Price. I believe it's Price.
Yeah, the younger
one. The kind of quirky, goofy-looking one?
Yeah, he's kind of a redhead.
Yeah,
so he's... And it's great to see him do, you know, it's like it's a fun role, but still... You know, a drama. It's great to see him.
He had that great line where they're talking about who craves sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And Zeller says, recovering alcoholics. You know what that is.
Mm-hmm.
And Price says, I'm not recovering.
I'm not recovering.
Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly.
Well, I have to say, as somebody who's analyzed CSI before, they are playing up on the sort of kitsch of CSI, but they're doing their field work correctly.
Mm-hmm.
They are not contaminating crime scenes. They are picking things up the proper way.
Again, using rooms full of light to analyze. Mm-hmm.
And even when the victim wakes up, even momentarily to die later in the ambulance, they freeze everybody, tell everybody to not touch anything.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And... You know, that is the way to treat a crime scene. So I will That's my little dig at CSI. Because
well, the reason I say it's like CSI, it's the network notes thing, is it feels like at this point, and maybe it's because I know where the show goes, mm-hmm. but it feels like at this point, it's still not certain what it's going to be. You know, episode one utilizes a lot of material that we already know if we've read the books.
Yes.
Mm.
The Garrett Jacob Hobbs stuff is very accurate to that. So now we've moved beyond that. So I have a feeling that at this point they were breaking the show as, okay, we're going to deal with this overarching story, but we also are going to have a killer of the week.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think that really settles for about half the season before they start realizing they don't need that as much.
Mm.
And you see that they don't really want to do that. By in this episode, I don't think we meet the killer of the week until like 20 minutes in.
Yeah. Right.
Because they want to deal with the overflow from the previous episode and still deal with the Garrett Jacob Hobbs stuff, still go in with Abigail.
Mm-hmm.
So we open with Will at the shooting gallery. He's pulling his target in, and it's Garrett Jacob Hobbs. And so we immediately get this dreamy thing, because you can't really trust Will to be seeing reality. And that's already in the series.
That his hallucinations are really taking over.
It makes you wonder if those are actually hallucinations, if that's actually what Will's seeing, or if it's meant to be something else, if it's meant to show us something, if he's dreaming at that moment at home in bed, and we just don't see him waking up.
Yeah, because there are times where they very specifically make it look like it's a dream, because he does wake up. Yes. Then there are times where, I believe in that instance, where he's actually shooting at it, even though it's only a body that's lying, and it's hanging.
Yeah.
It's not attacking him. The eyes are open, but glazed over.
Very clearly.
Garrett Jacob Hobbs is dead.
Long been dead.
But
body.
But still shooting him as if it is going to attack him. In that, but then he's still there.
Right.
It he's sort of jolted out of this reverie. So is it just he loses himself in some moment in his head? Is it a hallucination? They don't really tell
you. I think that's part of what is becoming the DNA of the show, is that they're not always going to show us what's real and what's not.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of lends the show its dreamy quality.
Mm-hmm.
So then we go to Garrett Jacob Hobbs' cabin to, again, wrap up this story. We see the antler room, which is a beautiful set. But again, this sort of hyper-real set, how would anyone set that up? How would anyone be in that room? It's so cluttered and so difficult. How is that a productive or functional thing? You know, if Garrett Jacob Hobbs, if we're feeling him as a killer who utilizes the corpses rather than just killing for sport and fun.
Right.
Well, I was going to say the functional part of that cabin is the first floor. That's where he utilizes every single part of the bodies.
But aren't we meant to think that the antlers are to drain the blood? He hangs them on the antlers to drain the blood?
Right. But then he could bring them downstairs. I mean, that's sort of like a prize room, like where you would mount your head or the antlers of the animal that you killed. So for a moment, it's as though he has that, I have mounted my masterpiece, that's my kill, and then goes into practical mode.
So you think it's a...
It's a very temporary...
He can celebrate...
Yeah,
celebration while the body's being drained. Then he takes it downstairs, guts it.
Also could be that he wants to, you know, if he prizes that look, that girl, that style, he wants to look at her for a moment.
Right.
Okay.
Before she becomes piecemealed out for utilization.
Okay.
I think it also makes it look like ritual.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes.
And I think, and I can understand what you mean about how it is a room that seems like you wouldn't practically want to do this because
right.
it's covered in these antlers.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually only sort of walk through this the center. And then the sort of the beauty of it, this is when, you know, wanting to make something visually interesting for the audience
mm-hmm.
Makes it difficult because you're trying to also make it real.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you made it something real and just had a single antler thing up there in an empty room, you may not get the symbolic visual right. that this show is trying to utilize.
Yeah.
You know, it is much more breathtaking when you go in that room and it is covered in antlers. And it's also, it gives you a psychological reaction, too. Mm. Because it's a dangerous room to walk in.
One misstep and...
Yeah. yeah. They look sharp. They, you know, they're you're closed in.
Mm-hmm.
It's animalistic.
Mm-hmm.
You instantly get that aggressive animal feeling
from them. Yeah, it is definitely not conventional human thought.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It really, you know, especially since we're doing serial killers who have rituals and desires yes. and things that are so... This is painting that picture very clearly for you. And so it is interesting to go in there and have that, okay, well, he had to be very careful going in that mm-hmm. room and very deliberate. Well, maybe as an audience member that's trying to prop up that window of just belief in that moment,
right.
that it's not just, oh, those people just made it look pretty. You have that reaction of, can you imagine trying to bring in a body into this? Is this body still alive?
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with that in that room? What does he do? Is there a whole ritual moment? And then your
right.
brain
yeah.
can go to some really scary places when you try to imagine
yeah.
what went in. And what was nice about it, though, is that they weren't gratuitous with blood.
No.
There was just a little bit here and
yeah,
there.
Yeah, a little bit.
A couple
bit.
Of a little
You could see it on the
points.
On the antlers.
On the points.
A few points, not all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And no, just the mounting antlers.
The mounting antlers.
Right.
And that there was a little bit of pool on the
floor. On the floor, yeah.
Dark, not, mm-hmm. you know, they didn't splatter it everywhere.
Wasn't bright red.
Right.
Well, no, actually, that's a function of the sensors.
Oh,
Brian Fuller has
okay.
talked about one of the notes NBC gave him. Is as weird as it is, NBC seems to be trying to let him go as far as he wants to.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
By telling him things like, so if the blood is a little darker instead of bright red, you can show more of it.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Okay.
So it's actually this really
sense.
Weird dance
mm-hmm.
that he has with the sensors. Because, I mean... This show gets away with things that I've never seen on television.
Oh, yeah.
It's stunning.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely a give and take back and mm. forth dance. Well,
biologically, it would be darker
it would be dark,
by the point
yeah.
of someone discovering it. So it's going
sure.
to be brownish.
Mm.
But also, speaking of the room having so many antlers, it also gives a little bit of a hint as to possibly how many victims have been in that room.
Mm.
And does he use new antlers for each one? So every time we see a set of antlers in that room, does that signify a girl?
Right.
A missing girl.
I guess that it does. It makes you think, and it takes you down a really dark path, because now you're trying to, like Will, think like the serial killer.
Right.
Yeah.
And it makes it scarier, because nothing happens in that room.
Right.
You never see what really happens in there.
Right.
But your imagination takes you to some scary places when you see it.
Well, because you also see Will's face processing it. So you're trying to figure out, what is Will seeing?
Mm-hmm.
And then what should I be seeing that I'm missing here in this room? So then your imagination just runs wild, filling in all those blanks, like you said.
And I guess because they've already caught him and this is not an investigation, we don't get the walk back.
Right.
With Will.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely left up to our imagination at that point.
Well, and this is where the wrinkle is introduced. Jack Crawford asks, implies that Abigail, the daughter in the hospital, would be Garrett Jacob Hobbs' accomplice. And you immediately see Will's defenses come up because he saved this girl.
Mm.
She is the goodness that came out of this situation. And he insists that that's not the case. And then finds a long, curly red hair saying somebody else has been here, which introduces us to Freddy Lowndes. And Freddy Lowndes is a character from Red Dragon.
Well, Freddy Lowndes is a male character from Red Dragon.
Yeah. That's valuable to mention. I find it silly that we're supposed to believe this Tatler Crime website is as important in this universe as the Tatler newspaper was in the Red Dragon universe. The whole point was it's this thing, this shocking thing, that this reporter has information right away. And, you know, it's a completely different era now.
Yeah.
Oh, so to see Freddy sitting naked in front of her computer, which was lovely, because that actress is Lara Jean Chirostecki, is lovely.
Mm-hmm.
When she's moving her little picture into what looks like Apple's version of Microsoft Paint to immediately publish to the internet. I don't know. Maybe that is the Mac web development platform. I have no idea. The show is taking us to a place. And we're being asked to buy it.
Yeah.
Okay, sure, I'll buy it. Because Freddy Lowndes is an interesting character. But really, tabloids don't have nearly the significance that they did.
No.
When Red Dragon came out in 1980.
Yeah, but I think that's what Freddy Lowndes is in this. She's internet fame whore, basically. Mm-hmm.
Which brings us to the first Hannibal credit sequence, because episode one did not have a credit sequence.
No.
What do you think about the Hannibal titles?
It was funny, because when it started, I was like, wait, whoa, okay. Oh, that's right, pilot. Now we have money. And we
Blood
can
Against Wife. Yeah.
And we can do open credits, because we know we're going to do the show.
And I was trying to discover this last episode. Mm-hmm. Brian Reitzel is the composer.
Mm-hmm.
And he does just wonderful incidental music on this series. Jack is sending Will to therapy. And we have a wonderful moment with Caroline DeHaverna, who is the lead character from Brian Fuller's previous series, Wonder Falls.
Because I do like her presence there, because there's such a soft interaction between her and Will. Because all the other interaction, especially because with Crawford and Hannibal, there is like a tango going on. So it's nice to have that counterbalance. But I do a lot of analyzing of design, because it's my background. And since every single outfit she's in has some sort of... It almost looks like a pen and ink.
It does. I noticed that a lot.
There's
episode.
Always some kind of pattern on her.
Mm-hmm.
And at first I thought, well, because sometimes these choices are made because you get product placement, or you get a certain designer will send you things, or a certain store, or that just happens to be, when you go to the store, that's what's there.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is in the same pattern because that's what's in. This second episode, I started to think that it was deliberate. Because she's in that beautiful dress. She talks about the book she's reading and about how she wanted to raise peacocks because of the book. I realized that the dress she's wearing looks like peacock feathers. If that's deliberate, I wonder if this palette that they paint her in, because everyone is very, and there's also a deliberate palette change for Hannibal in this one, which I thought was really interesting. Because they were so much in the same palette, and Hannibal spends this entire episode in the dark saturated colors like Crawford. So I was like, okay, this is a very interesting choice. What is the power or dynamic change here? That they are no longer presented equally. He's now being presented like this other oversaturated world, and now Will is the only one who
is. It could be because this episode sends Will to therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So Hannibal becomes this sort of authority figure to Will. Will didn't see Hannibal that way. Will saw him sort of maybe on the same page, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But now he goes to see Hannibal and has one of my favorite lines when Hannibal says, here's your approval.
You can
go back to work. And Will just says, did you just rubber stamp me? Will says, the last time he sent me into a dark place, I brought something back.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious what you two think, because I think it's the raven stag that he brought back, because that's a reoccurring element, and that shows up again in this episode. And Hannibal perceives it as Abigail is what Will brought back.
Right.
And Hannibal asks if, you know, they talk about if they feel a sense of responsibility. And Hannibal says this line, "I feel a staggering amount of responsibility." Mm-hmm. And I feel like this is Hannibal recognizing the responsibility he has for who Will is and who Will may become. Mm. Because the rubber stamping of Will is just a see how he runs.
And that's typical of Hannibal. He just wants to see what people are going to do.
Will is far more interesting to him out in the field than just as a, maybe you shouldn't go back out in the field. Let's just talk for a while. There's a lot of really good dialogue in that scene.
There is. Because they say things that are so profound.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, yeah, this show does not have any, like, minor banter.
No.
Everything is so dense. Hannibal says the mirrors in your mind can reflect the best of yourself, not the worst of someone else. Which says so many things, because Will is feeling like the mirror in his mind is reflecting Garrett Jacob Hobbs, because if Garrett Jacob Hobbs is a killer and he killed Garrett Jacob Hobbs, well, I must be a killer too. Mm-hmm. And it also says, well, I'm reflecting Hannibal because we're alike, you and I. And there's so much there.
Oh, yeah.
Well, let's take ourselves to the first creative killer tableau. The kids find the field of mushrooms. And that's really, I think, what made it feel so much like CSI.
Mm-hmm.
Is, yeah. Okay, here's some new characters. They're stumbling across a crime scene.
Mm-hmm.
So it's either going to be someone just dies on camera, or here's some stuff that's happening.
Well, it had such a Stand By Me feel. The whole time I'm going, oh, don't draw this out. You know you're going to find a body.
Yeah, right.
But what was wonderful about it is that we see a body in a way that I was not expecting.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah. Right. Nothing yeah. you've so seen before.
Yeah, so that was nice because I was sitting there going, you know, like kind of rolling my eyes mm-hmm. like, oh, okay. What the hell is that? And then it's a question I wanted to ask last night. Is because we are doing a weekly series and we do have to come up with more killers
mm-hmm.
and more ways of killing, and not having read the books yet, how much of this are they drawing from?
Nothing. None of the killers of the week after Garrett Jacob Hobbs comes from books.
None of them.
Because I saw that first shot of all those bodies and I was thoroughly impressed with the person that came up with this concept.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that's interesting about the Hannibal Lecter stories in general, and the reason we use the term tableau for this, is because the killers are all metaphorical. You know, the way they kill all feeds into this metaphorical idea.
Mm.
So this killer, the metaphorical idea, which is kind of hokey, and I don't quite buy it, is that the mushroom farmer, feels akin to the mushrooms because they connect even though they're not part of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I plant mushrooms because I want to make the bodies connect. It's kind of...
It was a bit of a stretch. Yeah.
No, he was talking... Well, okay, yes to that, but also he was saying that he wanted to recreate that... sensation of how, or not sensation, but the fact that the mushrooms will, or the fungus will move
mm-hmm.
when you walk through a forest of them, where they will reach out to try to touch you, slime mold.
But what I'm saying is, you don't need to plant a body.
No.
To get mushrooms.
No.
To do react that. To.
They will do that
so
without
him as a killer.
But his idea was not that he was planting the bodies to have mushrooms. To do that, it was because he talks about this at the end, and that's why he had hoped that Will would understand him. It's less about creating just the fungi. It's that human beings in his world don't reach out.
Right.
He is isolated from people. There is no connection.
Mm-hmm.
And here is this substance, this living thing that reaches out. So he was trying to create something in which a human being and the fungi were together
mm-hmm.
to facilitate this thing that he doesn't see happen in the real world. It makes no frickin' sense because he's a serial killer.
Right.
He's crazy. It's one of those things that's good that it's only, if it only is one or two episodes, it's about as long as it's going to last.
Yeah.
Well, but that's really what this this universe produces is metaphorical killers. In the books, Francis Dolaride was becoming the Red Dragon, and so his kills were about that. James Gum was transforming from man to woman, and so his kills were included the pupa of the moth because it was about transformation. So we're being asked to buy that serial killers, which by and large are not a very metaphorical group of people.
No.
They're generally focused on a very specific thing. Are somehow more creative in this universe, are somehow drawn to these operatic displays of how they feel. And right off the bat, we're being shown this and saying, this is how they behave. And so that becomes the blueprint for the series here.
Or the specific blueprint for which Will is called in for.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
Well, of course, it just feels like there are an awful lot of serial killers in the greater D.C. metropolitan area.
Yes, and very creative.
Led us to a really cheap 7 jump scare.
That
got you, Ophelia.
Oh, it got me both times.
Oh, yeah.
I jumped three times. The 3 times I've watched it, I still jump every single time. Because I know it's going to happen, but...
The scariest thing for most people is the idea of being buried alive. And even though they do wind up saying that they're not really conscious of it.
Right.
But there's that moment
But they're still alive.
Yeah.
And you get Will in his backwards pendulum flashback thingy burying this poor living person. The sound design in that sequence was just Brian Retzel saying, I'm going to make this my own. You know, he did a little of that in the first kill in the series. And just the look, the reverse time lapse of the footage where you see actual slime molds forming.
Yeah.
And it was just a gorgeous sequence. And they really amp up the color when we're in these moments.
Yeah, whenever he's in his walk back moments, it's very saturated.
The visual of the mold that was used more than once.
Yeah, that was used again later when he's talking about how it reaches out.
And the imagery of how they chose shots and footage where it does look like the synapses of the brain and nerve endings reaching out and expanding and the messages being sent across. I thought that was really nice imagery with the mold there.
Yeah. And it was a great connection with Will because it makes him think about how, not only how does he touch people to figure out what they do, but how much of them then becomes part of him in that process.
Yeah. And that, again, brings us back to that line. Last time he sent me into a dark place, I brought something back. So it makes you really wonder, you know, because Will does not do this professionally until Jack Crawford walks into his classroom and says, let me borrow your imagination.
Yeah.
So Will is now doing this professionally. You know, and Jack does the same thing in this one. What do you know about gardening? And that's another one of those CSI things. It's like, oh, look how cute we're being.
Right, right. We're going to tease this little tip of that.
But then in the middle of this, you know, we're in this CSI investigative mode, and Will's in therapy, and Will's talking to Hannibal, and then this amazing scene where Hannibal meets Freddie Lounge shows up. Freddie's got her whole story, and Hannibal just, are you Freddie Lounge?
Yeah.
And it's just, it's so, he knows, and he knows immediately. I love it.
Oh, when he asks her for, you know, for her pocketbook.
I need your purse.
Need your purse. erase this, the authoritative.
He makes her do it.
Yeah.
He could do it, but he makes her do it because he wants her to undo what she'd done.
Yes. Yeah. And the also her first impression of his office when she walks in.
She's amazed.
She is amazed as to just what's like on the other side of that door.
Well, who has an office that looks like that?
Right. A true story.
Other than somebody on TV.
And Will, in the first scene in Hannibal's office, Will is up in the corner on his balcony library, as far as you could possibly be from the therapy area.
Right. Yes. Well, and then he walks it.
Yeah.
And they do that whole tracking shot
and
where they're having
the conversation.
Hannibal's down in the center.
Well, you got to ask yourself, okay, now that's got to be a symbolic thing. Will is above Hannibal in the moment. Hannibal is looking up to Will and trying to figure out this unique and elevated being that he's never encountered before. Because Will is something different, which is why he intrigues Hannibal.
Right.
It also gives Will that opportunity to give space because he doesn't trust Hannibal.
Right.
He knows there's. He doesn't know what it is yet.
Yes.
But from the get-go, he's been kind of, I don't quite trust him.
Right.
But he sort of reluctantly. It's almost like he's talking to him not because he feels like he's actually going to do anything. It's like, well, I got to talk to somebody.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They're going to make me talk to somebody.
Yeah.
I may as well talk to this interesting weird guy.
Right. Exactly. And go through
these
motions.
There's something about him that he's also equally intrigued.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But that is kind of interesting that it is. He chooses sort of like the furthest that he could possibly be.
And it's contrasted in this scene when Hannibal sits on his little couch and he pats the seat next to him and invites Freddy over to sit with
like,
him
on
the little couch.
Yes. This is not going to be good.
And at this point, going in fresh, we as an audience still don't quite know what the deal is with Hannibal.
Right.
We know it was strongly implied that he eats people.
Yeah.
We made assumptions. We haven't seen any evidence of that yet. We know that he probably was the copycat from the Minnesota Shrike and that her lungs were missing and that Hannibal happened to be cooking lungs. Which I didn't know you could just cut up like that. I didn't know lungs were a solid thing, actually. I thought they were like bags. I have no idea. Really don't know about human anatomy. So
They're more solid. The one thing that sent chills down my spine would be the padding of the seat next to him and then the line, "You have been terribly, terribly rude, Miss Lowndes. What are we going to do about that?" And then I was like, that's it. Yeah. She's done.
I thought the same
thing.
We are never going to see her in another episode.
Freddie's not even in episode one. She's mentioned. But she's not actually shown.
And
for me, this is me from the I've read the books being like, okay, well, Freddy Lowndes is in Red Dragon.
Yeah.
So they couldn't possibly kill her already.
No.
I was quite surprised when we saw her later on.
And then they cut to loin.
The loin with the rich blood red sauce.
Exactly. And that's what was so, it was like, it was deliciously manipulative.
Because every
bit of that just it's like dripped
so
menace.
Tense.
And I was like,
this whole scene here where Jack is having dinner with Hannibal, just scream. I mean, it's the kind of thing that when Jack realizes that Hannibal Lecter is a cannibal, he's going to be like, fuck.
I hated his house.
Because, I mean, it's just full of lines where Hannibal's like, get it?
Yeah.
Because I'm a cannibal.
Yeah.
You know, he says, next time bring your wife, I'd love to have you.
That was one of my favorite lines.
He may as well be wearing a hello, I'm a cannibal name tag.
I would love to have you both for dinner. Yes.
Oh, dear.
Well, and I love the implication because Jack is such a hardworking guy.
Right.
And I love the implication that he gets out and he goes and he has this really fancy dinner with this really fascinating and erudite and guy, Hannibal Lecter. And this is Jack's boys' night.
Boys' night.
Essentially. I'm going to go hang out with Hannibal.
And what was wonderful is that during all of that, then he does the thing that Will does about, oh, is this therapy? Because he starts analyzing his relationship with his mother.
And Hannibal has that, we've already talked about your mother. That wonderful line.
Yeah, exactly. We might as
Why stop there?
Why stop there? and the sort of amused little nod to it that Crawford gives, like, oh, you got me there.
I guess I'll just have full access to my mental facility.
Exactly.
Just walk right in and make yourself at
someone
home.
Here's my brain.
That can make this delicious, complicated pork loin can't possibly have an ulterior motive.
So we find, really, even talking about it, the killer of the week is the least interesting thing in this episode.
Yeah.
The fungus is interesting. The killer himself.
The way it was killed, the whole thing. Yeah. He was kind of creepy when they were figuring out who he was.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, well, he has to have access to people who are diabetics. Right. Mm-hmm. And he must be following the medication. And when he wasn't speaking, he was very creepy and intense. And then we get to the end, and it was a little it was a little bit of a letdown.
Well, there's an interesting moment. This is Brian Fuller, creator, just being flagrant here. Shailen Simmons, she plays a character named Gretchen Speck Horowitz, who got divorced and
so
lost,
no
the hyphen.
Lost the hyphen.
Well, what's interesting is she also plays Gretchen Speck Horowitz on Wonder Falls.
Really?
Yeah. Same name.
So it's Brian Fuller brought her back and said, why don't you just play the same character? Because that character obviously moved from Niagara Falls region and then almost got killed by a serial killer.
Yeah.
So my favorite part of this sequence, though, is the SWAT team in the grocery store.
Yes.
Oh,
I love the incongruity of these men in black with their guns and flashlights just moving down the aisles at the grocery
frozen
store.
Food section.
Yeah, it reminds me so much of Hot
huge.
Fuzz.
Oh.
Yes. It was an impossibly huge supermarket,
very,
too.
Very, very large supermarket.
Because they just kept going and going. And then the way it was painted was, you had these guys all in black in this brightly lit supermarket with these really bright paintings on the wall. I'm like, you're not hidden.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, they're, you know.
I mean, they may as well be wearing camouflage.
Yeah.
For as hidden as they were.
Yeah, it was hilarious. That moment was kind of hilarious of all. And yet, there's this entire huge group.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And he's not there.
Right.
It's like, how did you not know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, he just got out at some point.
Yeah.
But what struck me in this scene is Will gets out to the car, and he takes the lead. I mean, this is a special investigator. Mm-hmm. This isn't SWAT. This isn't, you know, even really an agent. He grabs the baton. He breaks the window. Well, it's not even that he knows. It's that I think he's desperate to not have the killer get someone in front of him when he can stop it. So he is going to be the one to break the window, get into the car, and pop the trunk full of fertilizer.
Yeah.
And you think he always has his trunk filled with fertilizer in case he finds that special someone?
That's a good point.
Because it was a nice car.
You know, it's a really big supermarket. You could just have it.
He bought a little in the fertilizer section. That's very true. Very possible.
And you also don't know how much preparation had gone up to that point.
Right. Because
they had really kind of cheated us out of process at this point. Mm-hmm. And again, we often have to deal with the constraints of how much time they have to tell a story.
Yes,
sure.
Yes.
Well, I think
they have to wrap it up.
I think that's the thing that we see is that Brian Fuller may have been coaxed to make this a procedural, but he really had no interest in making it procedural.
Yeah.
So even and this is something we will see recurring this season is no matter how interesting the killer of the week is, we spend less and less and less time on the procedural nature of that crime.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it'll often go to, here's a killer, and oh, look, we found him. Let's go talk to Hannibal about it.
Wow.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And that really starts, I mean, even in episode 2,
we
it's apparent they're not interested.
Yeah. And it's a shame that they have to do that, because What's wonderful is them figuring out how this happens, and the team in there realize, well, how is this hooked up? How is it, and how they tell you how the whole thing works and where it's done, and then Will is the one that figures out that it's the people who are diabetic.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Without all
acidosis.
Yeah, the no lab, you know, results, no nothing. They're trying to think about it, and he just comes up with it.
Yeah.
You know, right there.
It's Will. It's needing to set Will up as the smartest man in the room.
Yeah.
What makes Will unique is that he makes these leaps that no one else would actually make.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
Which and I imagine he makes these leaps and is sometimes really wrong about them.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes really right about him. I mean, because he can't just be right all the time. He's not Hannibal Lecter.
That's why I wasn't surprised that he was like, no, you know, is his car still in the parking lot?
Right.
And what I assumed during that time is that while we were not seeing that scene through Will's perspective, we were seeing it as, here's this action sequence.
Yeah, here's the SWAT team.
With SWAT team, and they storm in, and everyone does the deer in the headlights thing, and we laugh because, you know, and then he's not there, and right. You're like, oh, no. I'm sure that while all this is happening, Will is processing.
Oh, yes. He's thinking about how he would have transported bodies.
So it's like, okay, well, he's found his victim. What would he do?
If he has indeed just logged off his computer,
mm-hmm.
He does not have enough time to get that body to safety if he has his next victim. And he's also thinking about, he knows that he must start a new garden because we just dug it all up.
Exactly. We've kind of set all that up. So I'm not sure if he knew exactly when he got to the car, because he broke in, and there's nothing in the car.
I'd imagine you could smell that
trunk. He knew that there was something in there.
And a body that's already going into renal failure.
Yeah.
You're going to have some smells.
But he already had an idea. He was having his moment.
Right.
He's there. He's already doing the steps that the killer is doing, even though we're not following it with him. So that's why he takes charge.
And thinking probably 7 or 8 steps ahead of the SWAT team.
Exactly. So it's like, okay, we need to forget
whose only thought is, how can we blend in at the grocery store?
Exactly. Against this, against the frozen food section.
Should have just been wearing all white.
So Jack goes and yells at Freddie Lowndes for a little while.
Yeah.
Threatens her, okay, obstructing justice, blah, blah, blah. It's back and forth and back and forth. That's really just designed to show two very strong personalities butting heads, and really just remind us that Freddy is part of this show.
And also that there's a mole.
Yes.
Yeah.
I really felt that was the true purpose of that scene.
Right.
Is that it's not just that she gets the local cop to talk, or she hides behind the door, that there is a mole within
the department. It's that our good friend Zeller, of our favorite lab tech team, is a mole for a moment that is really inconsequential for the rest of the series.
Right.
This is really why I feel that episode 2 is a bit of a weak episode, is because they're not sure what their dynamic is. And really, that's true about a lot of shows, episodes.
Yeah.
Is they have really powerful pilot, that's what gets them sold. Mm-hmm. Then they take it to series, and it's like, okay, well, we got to follow that pilot up with something. So let's, I don't know, a garden full of mushrooms. Let's try that.
Yeah.
But we do have this wonderful sequence in the hospital where Will is clearly sleeping, and we see him imagining Alana's footfalls into the raven stag walking down the hallway. Which is really another one of those beautiful sequences that's designed to keep us off kilter. Even though this one's clearly a dream sequence, because we see Will
sleeping
at the same time.
It's also one of the very big Lynchian moments.
Oh yeah,
mm-hmm.
That's the color choices and the lighting choices.
The lights in the hallway off.
Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
But it is, and that's one of the things I know we keep bringing up Lynch. Though he's never stealing.
No.
It's definitely using an inspiration.
It's as though Lynch created a language for television.
Exactly.
And Brian Fuller is speaking that language.
Exactly.
And he's speaking it very well.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes better than Lynch, because Lynch gets a little too self-indulgent.
Yeah.
the scene between Will and Alana where they talk about Flannery O'Connor in this book, this is a lovely sequence. And again, it feels very Network Notes because it feels like, okay, Will's going to need a love interest.
Yeah.
And why not make it this woman who's never been alone in a room with him because he's so off the wall? You know, we had that conversation between her and Crawford about if she was ever going to do a study about him, it'd be after he was dead because it's a little nuts.
Yeah. You know? She doesn't want to get that close.
But it is a lovely sequence. And Caroline de Haverna is just really engaging.
Mm-hmm.
And their back and forth is so nice there. And, you know, Will is being set up as this romantic lead, which is a little off kilter because Beverly Katz earlier at the gun range is so clearly
flirting with him.
Oh my god!
Oh, that whole thing of positioning his body
and Nosley's
that sequence was the number one thing that backs up what I said last episode, where Will's psychosis is different after the pilot, because the Will of the pilot, who couldn't even look Jack Crawford in the face,
would not
have let Beverly Katz touch him.
Yeah, that's true.
That is very spectrum.
It's fine, because I like this version of Will, and I don't think you could get as far with as standoffish a version of Will as you see in. See, what we've done is we've taken it from this really extreme version of the character of Will Graham. Mm-hmm. And if you look on the other side, you've got William Peterson playing... No, let's go with Edward Norton playing Will Graham from Red Dragon. Very, normal, clean-cut, you know, farm boy, take care of business Will Graham.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We've gone back maybe a quarter towards that Will Graham.
Okay, a throwback to earlier, I believe earlier in this episode, where he's talking about how he should just go back to fixing boat motors in Louisiana.
Actually, that's later. That's in his conversation with Lecter.
I thought that was very interesting. I'm like, wait, I don't think I can picture this Will
doing that.
Ever.
Yeah. Because, you know, and maybe it's, I don't know, it's maybe it's the Will. Isolation. Because a guy who's just fixing boat motors, it's something simple, it's a problem-solving thing, and he wouldn't have to deal with people. But yeah, it is a very different Will Graham being given the same things as Book Graham.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know if I see this particular character
doing that
activity for a living.
Yeah, well, it just as a device for the moment, it made sense because there is you can go back to the simplicity of a machine and not have to deal with the complexity of people.
Right.
And he's dealing with the complexity of people on two different planes.
Oh yeah,
because he's trying to deal with serial killers, and then he's trying to deal with the fact that he can't deal with people every day.
Mm-hmm. Right.
His social exclusion.
Yeah.
Speaking of the Lynchian moments, the pull out of the cream in the coffee
is
the most Lynchian thing in this entire episode. It immediately recalls the episode of Twin Peaks where we pull out of the ceiling tile, the acoustic ceiling tile, down to spoilers. Down to the killer of Laura Palmer.
Well,
I love how in control Freddie is when she's talking to that cop, the ex-cop.
Oh, right.
Until our sociopath of the week walks up and just shoots him in the fucking head.
Yeah.
And it's this
face. Great moment of just, okay, I'm not in control of anything.
Yeah. Apparently, this is not going according to my plan.
My plan.
All I can hear is Bill Paxton. Game over, man.
Game over, man.
And, you know, we see like things crumbling for characters in the last part of this episode. And it's interesting because it takes us sort of out of this killer of the week thing. Because the moment Will realizes that Abigail is not in the hospital room.
Yeah.
He becomes unhinged.
Immediately. Like,
you know, like I was doing just fine, and then you went and took my girl.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's got his gun out. You know, and that's a thing that a lot of people criticize in cop shows, is cops don't pull their gun until they need to
use it. They don't.
Will has his gun out when he's walking by all these people in the hospital. He's got his finger on the trigger. He's ready to shoot somebody.
Yeah. Yes.
And when he does finally shoot, we probably should know the name of the...
Stemets, I think.
But it's
close.
An example of how sort of unimportant this guy is.
No, what I thought was interesting about the way he was shot is we spent an entire episode watching Will do his practice and not ever hit the center of the target.
Right.
And that's the whole thing, is that he can't.
And he wound up shooting him in the leg.
He's all over the place. So when he talks about when he was shooting him, it's not deliberate.
Right.
You know, it's sort of like, I meant to shoot him.
Right. I meant to kill him.
I was unable to. And so it seemed like a logical conclusion from where he had been earlier, where he was all over the place. And even though they tried to, like, fix his stance, he was still not very good.
Right.
So he didn't keep him alive necessarily because he meant to.
Right.
But they kind of present it in a way did he do it on purpose or did he not do it on purpose?
Right.
Because he doesn't say it specifically.
Well, the series did it on purpose because they needed to give that killer... here, let me explain why I do things.
Things moment, right. Yeah. If they had killed him, he wouldn't be able to do that.
We're the same, you and I.
We're simpatico.
And it's like, for a series that's setting up the similarities between Lecter and him, to play the same game with this miscellaneous, we can barely remember his name, mushroom farmer, it's a little almost insulting.
It was interesting that he had hoped that this was going to be the one person that would understand him.
Yes. And maybe that's part of it too, is that I don't feel he understood Will Graham enough to want that connection with Will Graham.
I don't think it's...
We're going to say that Freddie Lowndes' single article that he read about Will Graham was like, oh, yeah, this is a guy.
It is a very broad device.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. Because I don't think, as well, that he would learn everything he needed to do about Will. But it is the implication of, oh, my God, he's just one person who connects with serial killers in a way that nobody else does and connects with
his own.
So maybe I'm going to finally find somebody.
Okay. I can go with that.
Is going to get what I'm doing. Right. And not necessarily, but because he is twisted, he doesn't realize that Will is going to get it, but is not going to be like, wow, dude, this is really cool.
Not going to be high five.
Exactly.
All right.
Wow. Wish I had thought of that.
We'll reach for each other in the garden or whatever.
That he is so far removed from reality that he wants to believe that Will understand and appreciate.
Yes.
What he's doing,
what he's
because
trying to do.
He has his inability to connect with human beings. But what Semmes doesn't realize is that he's still an FBI investigator that wants to end this.
Right.
Yes.
And doesn't want this stuff to happen.
Right.
So he's not going to have that connection that Semmes wants, because he doesn't realize that, no, he connects because he wants to stop you.
Yeah.
Not because he wants to
help you be your buddy.
Or be your buddy. Exactly. And it just shows him being very... He was far more twisted, actually. Mm-hmm. Than the first serial killer. More unstable.
More theatrical.
And theatrical. Yeah. Exactly. Even the way he was portrayed and the way he very creepily changed the medication and kind of stared at people, the women as they left.
Leered at Gretchen. Beck Horowitz.
Exactly. It was very... They started to get a little cliche.
Yeah, and maybe that's
And that's probably why we don't like
it. It feels very... They could have taken this killer and put him on CSI and the episode would have played very similarly. Mm-hmm. Oh, what yeah. really gives us something unique is this last sequence with Will and Lecter, and that feels like that's the entire point of the entire episode.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's this wonderful dialogue between Will and Hannibal,
mm-hmm.
where Hannibal suggests that Will's big fear is that the inevitability of there being a man so bad that killing him makes you feel good.
Good. Yeah.
When it's clear that Hannibal is saying that you know, when if you found out about me,
yeah.
mm-hmm. you know, being so bad, it would make you feel good.
Mm-hmm.
It's this lovely back and forth, and that's when he talks about the boat motors
yeah.
in Louisiana
yes.
there.
Yes.
Right. But you know, right away, you see this office, you see this beautiful set design,
mm-hmm.
and I want those curtains again so badly. they just, I don't know what it is, but every background on this show looks like it was hand-painted.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
It's just yeah. gorgeous.
Like when he has Freddie Lowndes sit down.
Yes.
Oh,
yeah. Stark contrast
the
of
colors.
This hot, like warm, deep,
the deep red, yeah.
The deep background in this cold couch.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That was icy in color. And
that's actually my Windows background.
It's just Hannibal sitting.
It's just Hannibal sitting there in the corner.
The couch.
And then a wide open expanse.
Yeah, it is. Just, everything about that was
yeah.
gorgeous. And the color and the starkness of it, that's, again, it's a lot of emotional manipulation.
Oh, yeah.
That's going on.
Well, and that's how he plays it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we've seen, you know, we've done this whole episode without really talking about the performances.
Mm.
But Hugh Dancy, while yes, playing a different Will Graham than the pilot,
mm.
Plays a more interesting and nuanced. Like he's got it right off the bat. Mm. And Hugh Dancy is British.
Yes,
and mm-hmm. very very rarely do you hear an odd.
No, he plays it amazingly
right.
well. You don't get any feeling. What's nice about it, it's natural.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because you don't get the feeling that this is someone doing an American accent.
Yeah. And maybe it's helped by the fact that Will has such unique delivery
mm.
in general. Because
true.
Often Will feels like he's sort of pushing his thoughts out
mm.
because he's having such a hard time connecting with someone. So he's like forcing himself yeah. to speak to them.
And precise, stilted, and literal language is a staple of Spectrum.
It ends with a very, very common exchange from the books with Hannibal Lecter, because he, in silence, he talks about collecting church collapses.
Yes.
Yeah, and he brings it up here.
And really, having gone through these books again recently, it's like Hannibal won't shut up about church collapses. And so, you know, when we watched
yes.
through the first time, it's like, oh yeah, that church collapse thing, that's cool that they pulled it out. And then rereading the books, is like, okay, there's like six or seven, I don't know, in the whole series.
A lot of them.
So in that, where he's talking about the roof collapsing and killing 34 people who were, you know, sort of worshipping him at the time, and in the books, it's a delivery through a letter
yeah.
that is written to mm. Will from Hannibal Lecter, and he's trying to help Will feel better about killing Hobbes.
Yeah.
Mm.
And he's saying things like, well, it feels good when God kills,
mm.
and surely you can have this one.
Right.
This one really bad guy.
Because what could it matter?
What could
right.
it matter
right.
in the
saves
grand scheme
by
of things?
His life.
But in the show, they sort of spread the line over to Will. And it's not just Hannibal saying God feels good. It's Will saying
mm.
God feels good. Or does or
Will
questioning.
Asking.
He was
yeah.
sort of making the question, posing the question.
Does
to Hannibal,
God feel good?
Does God feel good about that? And then Hannibal saying, well, he certainly feels
powerful.
Which is such a great connection between both Hannibal and Will. It's,
yes.
You immediately know that when Hannibal kills, he feels powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And he's giving Will permission to feel the power he felt. Mm-hmm. Because now Will has killed a man. Yes. And shot and disabled another man.
Yeah.
In the space of, I don't know, a week.
Right.
The timeline is very fucked.
No, they don't really give you an idea. It's like the way everybody was, you know, dressed in this episode. I was like, we did everything in one day. Nobody like went to sleep and changed their clothes. This really only happened in one day. I mean, it didn't look like anybody changed.
Right.
Everyone had the same look from the beginning to the end. So I was like, oh, episode two was just, it's
all in one day. 24.
All in one day. 24.
And then after the he felt powerful line is a very abrupt cut to black.
Yes.
It's like the scene didn't even end. It's like, that's it.
Yeah. That's it.
But that's what he's basically telling him is essentially why serial killers do what they do. There is a power in what they do and a control.
Mm-hmm.
And it's less about the need to do something good or any kind of revenge or any... The way most people usually kill in anger.
Mm-hmm.
And it's less about being powerful than it is sort of an extension of people's sort of anger and frustration and more maybe control.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what he's trying to hint at in this is that there's something even bigger going on here, in that there is a power in doing all of this.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah. And I found it interesting as I thought that he was sort of providing some insight very indirectly.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and whether or not Will is going to then put that puzzle together later mm-hmm. on. Because he gave him a little treat.
Feeding him a little bit.
Yeah.
You know.
Just like he's giving Jack Crawford the...
Right?
Oh, basically I'm a cannibal. Wouldn't it be funny if I was a cannibal?
Right, yeah.
I have to editorialize myself again. Scott Thompson is from Kids in the Hall.
Oh, goodness, yes.
I confused him with another redhead that is Kevin Allison.
I saw a picture of him on IMDb when I was looking up the cast list while we were talking here, yes.
But it is, it's like a little bit of the Scott Thompson that we kind of know, but it's great to see him do this sort of drama, and he adds a very kind of fun edge to it.
Yeah.
Because when we're dealing with everything else, there is a little bit of humor here and there, even... Hannibal has some humor,
which is
wonderfully off kilter, but it's interesting that our CSI crew
is our
lab geeks are very quirky.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And that is very much Brian Fuller's influence there. Mm-hmm. That feels the most like his other work. Mm. Of all the things in this series, you know, he trends towards quirky and light.
Mm-hmm.
If you watch Pushing Daisies, it's nothing but quirky. Wonder Falls takes place in a tchotchke shop at Niagara Falls. So, I mean, there is not enough quirk in the world to sustain that. That's why it only got a season, is because it actually couldn't sustain itself on quirk. And so the lab techs are our gateway into that. And I really got that feeling in this episode as it's Brian Fuller being like, well, we can just have fun with them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It makes me wonder what they all do when they go home.
What do they do for fun?
What do they do for fun? Because they are each so interesting and like said, quirky and complex, and you know, the little jibes that they, you know, kind of throw out, and there's a banter.
It feels like a real working relationship.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It does.
Yes.
It does. Most definitely. It's very natural in the way they banter with each other.
So that's the end of episode two, the Moose Boosh. So we're moving on to another episode directed by David Slade next week.
It's going to be I'm looking forward to seeing where we go with these killer of the week. And I really, like I said, with Seven, I don't want it to like die down and become formulaic and just
promise you are going to see kills in this series that have never been seen in the history of television or movies ever.
I'm excited.
Period.
I know that sounds terrible to say.
I get it. We're right there with you.
Keep watching, you will not be disappointed.
Yeah. And to those listening at home, if you have a thought on episode one or two, you can email us, eattherootcast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at Eat the Rootcast. Thanks for joining us at the table.